listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, an in-depth look at the income and expenses of hundreds of families reveals some surprising truths about what it takes to get by in America. First, in the last century, the American public has seen bitter debates over everything from contraception to interracial marriage to same-sex marriage.
This is not just a battle for Democrats and Republicans and how they vote on issues. This is a spiritual battle.
We've had more couples come forward here that were living together without marriage, or more couples come forward here that have been separated, and more couples that have been divorced that have come here together and be reunited than almost any crusade we've held in a long time.
Hate Bill 2 is not a bathroom bill.
That's right.
We've said to the media, don't let them play you. It's not a bill to protect women and children from predators. It is a cynical attempt to pit supposedly Christian values against our family's best interests and our faith's highest morality. And
I can sit here and say that as a Republican, and I can say, you know what, I'm for limited government, so stay out of my guns, and you can stay out of my body as well.
We are the conscience of these United States of America. We are this nation's moral compass. If you want to know if you are going the right way, follow women of color, sisters and brothers. We know where we need to go, and we know where justice is.
Those were the voices of former Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, Reverend Billy Graham, Reverend William Barber, conservative commentator Tommy Lahren, and activist Linda Sarsour at the Women's March. Issues around sexual morality and gender roles have fractured American religious communities, and our next guest says those religious debates have created fault lines in American politics as well. R. Marie Griffith looked at a century's worth of those disputes in her new book. It's called Moral Combat: How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. She's also a historian of religion and gender and directs the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University in St. Louis. Marie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Marie, debates over contraception, abortion, and who Americans can marry aren't new. We've seen some iteration of them in just about every decade. How much or how little have those arguments changed over the years?
Well, that's a great question. Let me say, first of all, I loved those clips that you played at the beginning because it just shows this diversity of views coming out of the Christian community, for one thing. But, you know, we can get to that. But the point is, absolutely, the debates that we're having now, we've really been having for a century in one way or the other. My book and the research that I did sort of started with the birth control movement in the 1920s, Margaret Sanger, and her battle largely with the Catholic hierarchy at that time over birth control. But the debates have gone on, as you say, throughout this entire century over a whole array of issues from miscegenation and interracial marriage to sex education, abortion, which is certainly in part about sex, it's not only about sex, through same-sex marriage, sexual harassment, and on and on. It's just a debate we keep having over and over again.
Well, and it's interesting because I guess I had never really thought, I mean, if you ask people what are the big religious and morality arguments, they will list those things like abortion and same-sex marriage and contraception. But I don't know that a lot of people would immediately say, and they're all connected in some way to sex. I mean, sex really is kind of the touchstone for all of those issues.
It really is. You know, if you think about it, just going back 100 years, a century ago, Americans generally, and certainly American Christians, the vast majority of Americans had a kind of consensus about sexual morality, that the place of sex, the role of sex, was within marriage, which of course meant heterosexual, monogamous, lifelong marriage. And anything outside of that was forbidden, especially for women. I mean, people sort of looked the other way. Men behaved badly. I went to prostitutes. There's all kinds of stuff there. That wasn't good, but it was sort of tolerated in any number of ways. But for women, you know, those rules were extremely important and very, very strict. Over the past century, in one way or the other, those rules have sort of been reshaped, loosened, Women have gained sexual freedom through a variety of mechanisms, starting with suffrage and the birth control movement and on and on. And the reaction to that is really has been very powerful. And I see those issues as really being at the core of our political debates in all kinds of ways.
Well, and Marie, you said that women have made advances and have gained more rights in a variety of issues, but none of those were easy. They were all because of struggles and often generations of struggle. And was there a point where we hit a tipping point that some of those battles were winnable instead of, you know, women and their allies just trying to keep the issues in the public eye, but really not succeeding very often?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, because in a certain way, none of these debates are over. I mean, you know, so I look at particular debates in individual decades when they were strongest. But really, if you look at our contemporary world, these issues remain live conflicts, and many people continue to be distressed at these changes. So, for instance, birth control. I mean, birth control was fought out in the 1920s, 1930s. Griswold v. Connecticut in the 60s sort of finally makes birth control legal and available, or you know, at least technically available to people across the land. And yet, even today, as we know, we're still sort of battling over birth control, the contraceptive mandate, and the Affordable Care Act, yada, yada, yada. So, you know, all of these debates in some way continue to be very, very profound and live. So what's winnable is hard to say. Something aside wins, and then, you know, the reaction is very, very powerful on the other side.
We're talking with R. Marie Griffith about her new book called Moral Combat: How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. It seems like the decade of the 1960s is seen as, you know, this unfettering of all these different issues, whether it's drug use or sex or, you know, women exerting themselves in feminist thinking, and that the 1970s were kind of a backlash where we saw a rise of the religious right. Is that too simplistic an idea of those decades?
Well, no, I don't think that's too simplistic. It's certainly credible to say the 60s, a lot of things changed and shifted. Conservatives like Phyllis Schlafly at that time began to mobilize people and say, we can't have this. This is destroying the American family. It's destroying America generally. So you do get that backlash in the 1970s. But I do think it's important to go back even farther. I think the mistake we sometimes make is tracing it all back to the 60s instead of, as I see it, really back to the 1910s and 1920s and gains in women's rights. The ultimate victory of women's right to vote in 1920 spurred a tremendous backlash. We sort of forget that there were a lot of people who didn't want women to have the right to vote, including many women, by the way. And so that victory in 1920 really generates its own kind of backlash, and then those things continue to feed off each other over time.
Well, and it also seems that when women entered the workforce in huge numbers during World War II, because men were off fighting, there was also a backlash against that greater freedom that they had experienced in the economic realm when those men then came back home.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, I'm interested in why these backlashes occur. You know, what's behind it? And you know, in part, I think we can say there have been real fears about the impact upon women if they get too much freedom. And rather than mocking that fear, I've really tried very hard to understand, you know, what's at stake and really read and talk to people about what they've seen as being at stake. This real fear that somehow if women gain the freedom, more freedom, to live their lives as they want and to control their sexual lives and their reproductive lives outside, you know, of government and legal restrictions, that they won't want to support social structures like marriage and the family. They won't want to have children and be mothers and nurture people. They'll sort of become these very decadent, selfish, evil preachers, you know, and sort of anarchists outside of these all of these structures. And you know, as unrealistic as I think that depiction is, I think it does create real fears for folks, you know, that have generated, again, these backlashes all along the way.
And that's interesting because you talk about that in your book, that so many of these religious positions are really rooted in fear. And how would you describe what is the ultimate fear that is kind of the boogeyman for religious, especially conservatives? What is the picture that they think the future will hold if these things become commonplace and accepted?
Yeah, I think a future of decadence, you know, for children raised in chaotic homes, you know, filled with divorce or violence or, you know, just kind of selfishness. And ultimately, it's the decline of America itself. The nation itself is at stake. You know, there's been a long view held by many Americans, frankly, throughout our history, that we're sort of this chosen nation, you know, that God has kind of chosen us, selected us above all others. And even today, people who say they don't, you know, they don't believe that or they don't have a theological commitment to that, it goes deep in our kind of historical training, our public school educational, you know, training. And so one of the fears there is that if sexual sin, as some people see it, is allowed to flourish, God will remove his blessing from the nation, and the nation will fall as the Roman Empire fell. So, you know, it's almost an apocalyptic fear of just the collapse of America itself.
We're talking with Marie Griffith, author of the new book, Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you think political and religious groups react to changing views about sex? Do you think changing views on sex leads to divisions? And let us know if you have a personal example of how this has affected you in your life, either in your religious and moral beliefs or as maybe the object of those of others. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back to continue this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're talking with Marie Griffith. She's the author of the new book, Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. And we want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. How have you seen changing views about sex divide people? How do you think politicians react, and are they reacting the way that you think they should? What about religious communities and their reactions? Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. And Marie, one of the things that I was wrestling with preparing for this interview is it's kind of a chicken and the egg situation. What usually comes first? Is it that the public's idea about morality and sexual morality especially guides politics, or are there political decisions that are made that then kind of bring along public opinion with them?
Well, of course, it happens both ways, but I would say in general, people's views do change, and as that happens, you know, culture precedes politics to some degree, at least, and I think on these issues, that's largely been the case. Oftentimes, I think on these issues, there's been a sort of reformer, a big reformer in the public world, like Margaret Sanger or Alfred Kinsey, and I write about many others. Anita Hill or Paula Jones in the sexual harassment cases much later. And, you know, something about their story, their activism, you know, their life sort of begins to change hearts and minds of folks. And they, as they become very successful doing that, you know, those kinds of political shifts may follow. I mean, gradually, more or less, you know, over time. But I think it tends to go in that direction.
Let's go back to that point about sexual harassment and Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas. How did public reaction to that case relate to religion or ideas of morality?
Well, you know, what's interesting there, of course, Anita Hill was someone of very strong religious faith. She had taught at Oral Roberts Law School, and that part of her story didn't get a whole lot of attention in the public press, but many people did know that about her. And yet, you know, what really happened in that case, of course, was that liberals and progressives, religious and secular, supported her, while conservatives on the other side tended to support Clarence Thomas. It was really a case of, you know, in some ways, folks finding credible the positions maybe that they were already primed to believe, I mean, I think to some degree. What was so interesting, though, to me about this was that when Paula Jones made the accusations against Bill Clinton, and then these other things came up, and of course Monica Lewinsky eventually, and Whitewater, the whole Ken Starr investigation, there were a number of Christian legal organizations that very quickly supported Paula Jones and other cases against Bill Clinton. So their position sort of shifted, and their whole language around sexual harassment shifted very dramatically once they really agreed, you know, with the position of someone that they were taking on.
So in some ways, on either side, religious or moral beliefs were kind of being pressed into service for political ends.
Yes, I think that has often happened. And, you know, we've seen that today, that a lot of folks now are saying, you know, feminists, I mean, this is not even a religious issue, but feminists have sort of said, you know, we really should have responded differently to those accusers against Bill Clinton. We sort of look back now and say, you know, what he did was atrocious. And folks, some people have called for, said he should have resigned at the time. So, you know, those reckonings sometimes happen slowly, but in the moment, it very much did seem like folks, religiously and politically, yes, their views sort of got pressed into service to one side or the other.
We're talking with Marie Griffith about her book, Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. And you can join in by calling 800-642-1234. And Marie, of course, we are in the age of the Me Too movement and a huge wave of allegations against politicians from all across the political spectrum, from President Trump to Al Franken. How are you seeing religion and morality playing out today, 30 years after the Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas case?
Well, you know, you showed some of those clips at the very beginning were of progressive religious voices like William Barber, and there are many, many others out there. I think those progressive voices have been out there for a very long time, fighting against sexual harassment, fighting for women's rights, fighting for justice of many, many different kinds. You know, they don't always get, they're a little less flashy, and they don't always get all of the media attention, but I think they've been very, very prominent voices. There's been a strong movement around, of course, clergy sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, as well as in many Protestant denominations and churches. There's been a real, you know, movement to fight that and to get rid of that for a very long time. I think a lot religiously has been going on behind the scenes there, for sure. That's one religious story we could tell about that.
Well, and that's nothing new. In your book, you profile some deeply religious people with very strong religious convictions who have been at the forefront of a lot of these movements on issues of sexual morality.
That's right. Sex education is a great example. Sex education programs in the U.S. that are sort of the modern day, you know, anti-abstinence only sex education programs were pioneered by many Protestant clergy, and the activist Mary Steichen Calderon, who was a physician and a devoutly religious Quaker. So you really had very, very strongly religious people acting out of religious convictions in that movement in the 60s and 70s and beyond. Abortion is another great example. Many people have forgotten that some of the early abortion activists and folks really on the ground prior to Roe v. Wade also were Protestant clergy and religious actors who had seen women die of botched abortions, illegal abortions, and really saw it as a humanitarian cause to find ways to give women access to safe abortions. And so that happened certainly in Madison and New York and all over the country. So there are these really important stories of progressive religious folks being active on these issues all along.
Let's go to the phones. And Fred is on the road, calling originally from Kentucky. Fred, thanks for joining us.
Yes, ma'am. I just heard part of your conversation, but I'm a Southern Baptist. I'm a truck driver, and I've been married to the same lady for over 47 years, and we were both virgins, and all three of our daughters, as far as I know from my wife, were virgins before they got married, too. So the thing about, well, I'm against abortion because it takes away a life that God created, but in the case of rape or incest, I think it's okay. But
okay,
it's still
we're getting really. I'm sorry, Fred. We're getting really short on time, and I want to make sure that Marie has a chance to respond. Marie, it sounds like Fred, you know, his faith is very much a part of his beliefs and politically and individually.
That's right. And Fred, I want to say I was raised Southern Baptist, too. So that's very much the world I come out of, as you describe. I'm really interested in the sort of position that Fred describes on abortion, because I think there are a lot of people who hold that view, which, you know, we might think of as a sort of middle ground view, believe that abortion is wrong in many, if not most, cases, but that exceptions should be made. And there are other folks who think, well, abortion should be, you know, available in most cases, but even we would have restrictions, you know, for certain things. There's these maybe more middle ground positions that rarely get very much political ammunition, because that issue is so politically divided. But
and we're going to have to leave it there. Marie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Marie Griffith is a historian of religion and gender. She directs the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University in St. Louis, and she was with us to talk about her book, Moral Combat: How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.